Executive MBA program at Florida International University is a program for professionals who have already achieved business success. Now, the Executive MBA program is located on Brickell Avenue in FIU's new state-of-the-art facility. Classes are held two Saturdays per month. The deadline to apply is October 31st, and classes begin January 2013. Learn more at FIUEMBA.com or 855-FIUEMBA.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. How are you this afternoon, Bonnie?
I'm good. And you?
Very well. Hope the pledge drive is going good.
It's going great.
Great.
It's going great. We had great success this morning.
Well, this hour we discuss civics education and a Miami-Dade program to stress ethical conduct in government. Joining me now is the 2010 American Civics Education Teacher of the Year. She's Jackie Viana. She's the Teaching American History Grant Coordinator of Miami-Dade Schools. Welcome to you, Jackie Viana. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Also with us is the Executive Director of the Miami-Dade Commission on Ethics and Public Trust. He's Joseph Santorino. Of course, the Ethics Commission is an independent agency which oversees the conduct of government employees and officials. Welcome to you, Joe Santorino.
Glad to be here, Joseph and Bonnie.
Good to have you back. Joe Santorino, tell us about the Ethical Governance Day, the genesis of it, and what the aim is.
Well, it started really with our commission, the Ethics Commission, adopting a resolution to declare October 12th of this year as Ethical Governance Day. And the staff and I have been planning some events to commemorate that. And really the centerpiece of it is a program where we're putting probably about 200 volunteer public speakers into the public schools, into all of the senior government classes to speak specifically about civic participation and ethical government and the connection between those. We've gotten a great response. We still are looking for more volunteers, but we're close to the number we wanted. That's really the centerpiece, although we have encouraged other groups to do similar programs. And we're also running an ethics forum for all candidates on the Miami-Dade ballots this fall. There'll be a forum held that afternoon at the Stephen P. Clark Center, where all the candidates will be given some time to speak specifically about their plans and their vision for ethical governance. Won't be the typical political speeches.
Mm-hmm. And why did you feel that we needed to have an Ethical Governance Day?
Well, we need to have an ethical governance conversation every day of the year.
Right.
It certainly begins in the schools, but it goes far beyond that. I think we've all, in the work I've done, I know, and other people have done in this area, we do think that we need to strengthen the civic involvement of the public in Miami-Dade County. That's really one of the prerequisites for a healthy civil society, which is absolutely important to making democracy work.
Jackie Viana, how is the Miami-Dade school system involved in Governance Day?
The Miami-Dade school system is involved in, through the Division of Social Sciences, we are working closely with the Governance Day committee in providing the schools, the 12th grade classrooms that will be visited by these public officials. So we're coordinating those efforts. My supervisor, Bob Brzezinski, is coordinating those efforts.
Don't we think, or do you think, we should start teaching ethics at a younger age, though, than seniors in high school?
Absolutely. I was in the classroom for 18 years. I taught civics. And what I've seen, and I've trained throughout the state of Florida, nationally and internationally, on civic education, and what we see, the state of civic education in the country, not just the Florida, but in the entire country, is that kids need to be introduced to civic concepts at an early age. 12th grade is too late.
Right.
We need to start in elementary, middle school. And I am glad to let you know that in the county, we're in a very good shape We have been offering civics courses since the early 1980s in Dade County.
Let me just add to that. You know, I can attribute my public service career to my fourth grade teacher.
You were a longtime prosecutor.
Yes, I was. And before that, in my hometown in Massachusetts, I was involved in the city council up there. And I've always been involved in political and public affairs. But my fourth grade teacher opened my eyes and inspired me, I think, in many ways. It happened to be that I won't tell what year it was, but it happened to be a presidential election year. And she talked about it constantly. She got everybody involved in it. And then even after the election, she brought us through the creation of the new administration. And I really can tell you that that was an indelible experience for me. And I always cite that as really the beginning of my awakening to civic life.
Jackie Viana, tell us about some of your successful students. They actually introduced legislation that was passed here in Florida.
Yeah, when I first started teaching civics and I saw the faces of the kids, it's like, we need to learn this in seventh grade. I realized that I had to bring government alive to my classroom. It was not enough to open the book and teach them those concepts. And so there's a phenomenal program there. We actually have great success in the county. It's called Project Citizen, where kids find a problem in their community and they try to find public policy solutions to the problem. So we're teaching them at a young age, don't complain about your city or your community, but get involved and create some change. So my students have introduced several bills to the Florida legislature. Two of them became state laws, and they also have changed some local ordinances related to traffic lights and so forth. So I'm very, very proud of what my students did when they were in middle school. Imagine what can they do when they get to 12th grade.
I was going to ask just some examples of what they've done.
Okay, the first one, and it took them 2 years to work on this bill, was we have a drug-free zone in schools, and they realized that kids, especially in the community where I was teaching in Hialeah, we have lots of parks and libraries. It's very active. And so my students decided to try to pass a bill related to that, having a drug-free zone in parks and libraries. Mm. And the first year it only passed the House. And the second year passed the House and the Senate. And they actually went to Tallahassee twice to lobby for their bill. And Governor Jeb Bush at the time saw their enthusiasm and how hard they have worked for 2 years. And he came to my school and signed the bill into law.
Wow.
The second one was related to prescription drug medications, to pill mills.
Okay, and what was that?
Working together with different legislators, a teacher in my school lost her mother to prescription overdose, and my kids wanted to do something about it. So the bill put strict limits on pill mills, the so-called pill mills in Palm Beach County and Broward and Dade County.
That's we're speaking amazing. With Jackie Viana and Joseph Santorino. We're talking about Ethical Governance Day in Miami-Dade County. That's Friday, October 12th. If you'd like to join in with a comment or question, you're certainly welcome. 1-866-247-9576. 1-866-247-WLRN. And also email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
How old is the Miami-Dade Commission on Ethics and Public Trust, and why was it created, and who created it?
Well, it was created by the people of Miami-Dade County by referendum back in 1996 that added the Miami-Dade Commission on Ethics to the county charter and essentially gave it jurisdiction over all public servants in county government and in every single municipality in the county. We enforce the county's ethics code in terms of the compliance by all public servants, and we also do a lot of training. We train public servants and public officials in the laws and regulations, and we also give opinions. If somebody has an issue that they are concerned about, or, you know, this is something that we can do or I can do, we will give them an opinion and give them the guidance that they need to stay out of trouble.
So the commission can give fines and also subpoena power?
Yes,
how
we do.
How far
they
go?
We have investigators. We have subpoena power, and we do conduct investigations. Now, under our code, of course, we can't impose criminal penalties. However, we do work with local law enforcement, with the police, with the state attorney's office, because our code can carry criminal misdemeanor penalties when it's appropriate, when it's a serious enough violation.
I suppose a big part of having this ethics commission also is as a chilling effect, that just the idea that you're there will make people maybe walk a little straighter.
We like to think that, but we put a great emphasis on training and education. Well, we're in the schools, and we make ourselves available to candidates and groups to make sure people get the word on what the rules are about.
So what kind of ethics training do they undergo exactly?
Well, for instance, during election time, we will give prospective candidates a seminar in the campaign laws that govern campaigns and fair campaigning. And that's an important part of our training. We train lobbyists. The county commission has required that all county lobbyists undergo ethics training. In order to function as lobbyists, we train them. We have put together a training program for all 26,000 county employees, a four-hour training program that they will all undergo to make sure that they're acquainted with the requirements of being a public servant.
Right.
Because it's created by the commission, what happens if there are allegations against commissioners?
There have been, and we have, from time to time, imposed penalties against county commissioners, against mayors, city commissioners. That goes with the territory. I mean, that's the understanding that, and I think they all realize that we're there to guide them. But if they go astray, that we will step in and impose a penalty.
We're speaking with Jackie Viana. She's the Teaching American History Grant Coordinator of Miami-Dade Schools. And we're speaking with Joseph Centurino. He's the Executive Director of the Miami-Dade Commission on Ethics and Public Trust. Please join in our conversation. We need to take a short break. 1-800-743-9576 or radio at WLRN.org. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys. Every day, children are falling through the cracks, becoming victims of economic hardships like 12-year-old Lindsay, who no one knew existed until paramedics came to rescue her mother. There are many children like Lindsay at Kids in Distress. You can get more information at kidinc.org.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return 19 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman with you. And we're speaking with Jackie Viana of Miami-Dade County Public Schools and Joseph Centurino. He's the Executive Director of the Commission on Ethics and Public Trust. Tell me, Joseph Centurino, we have a lot of low voter turnouts and many citizens are just very jaded about politics. What can be done to stimulate more civic activity?
Well, you know, obviously our focus in this particular program is on the schools. There probably is really a very narrow window in which we can capture young citizens and rather than go through a life of alienation, go through a life of civic involvement. And you know, it's important that we capture them at an early stage to develop that. But it's also important that that parents and citizens recognize their connection and their responsibilities to bringing younger people into the system. And I would hope that with this program we have, where we've got about 200 citizens, including attorneys, public officials, and civic leaders, who are going to be going out into the schools on October 12th, that they're going to bring not only something into the classroom, but they're going to take something from the classroom and bring it home to their families and keep that conversation alive, because there's nothing, as far as I'm concerned, more important to ethical government than an active and engaged citizenry.
Do you think youngsters are more reluctant to get involved in public affairs now than they were in previous decades?
I think there are probably even more distractions today, and with the internet and so forth. And I suspect that, however, that there's still a great opportunity for engagement. I mean, this is a great system that we have in this country, and you only have to watch the evening news to see how far ahead we are in terms of things like freedom of speech and our ability to affect our government. So that's something that people need to be inspired about, and young people have to be made to appreciate.
Yes. And I also think that the programs that they are that they participate in, not only middle school but also high school, will encourage them for later on, you know, to want to get involved in government. And the Division of Social Sciences has phenomenal programs, and we have Project Citizen in the middle school and high school, but we actually have something called We the People, a phenomenal program where kids or students learn about the Constitution. And if you attend one of those public hearings, those congressional hearings, we have the judges, always are so impressed with what the young kids can do, what students can do. We have something called mock trial where they go and have an actual case from the Supreme Court or from the courts, and they participate. And then we also have moot courts. So those programs, active citizenship starts in the classroom by them actually participating in the classroom. So when they grow up and they go out to the workforce or through college, they will want to continue being active citizens.
Jackie, tell me about the civics end of course exam. I wonder how many of our listeners could pass that. Or maybe
John,
Bonnie and I.
John, that yeah. is a very, very good point. I was actually going to share some findings from the NAEP.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me questions.
I thought so, too.
I definitely
got
am.
Got nervous.
The NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. I serve in that committee as well, and I also serve in the committee that put together not the questions, Pearson does the questions, but the item specifications for the state. And I've seen some of the questions, and I am going to tell you some of the questions are very hard. We have three scholars, and we have teachers from across the state. We're eight people all together. And I must admit, I miss a couple of questions. And
I probably do better than that than on the FCAT.
It started with a law. It's called the Sandra Day O'Connor Law. It's mandated not only for civics to be taught at least a semester course in seventh grade, which, like I stated before, the county is ahead of the game. We've been teaching civics since the 1980s. But also, they have to pass an end-of-course exam, and it's a high-stakes exam in the sense that if they don't pass it as of right now, they cannot move to high school. So the Division of Social Sciences has created resources to help these teachers, help these students pass the test. And I'm confident that they will do very well.
You know, she mentioned the name of Sandra Day O'Connor. Sandra Day O'Connor, who was a great Supreme Court mm-hmm. justice and retired, she has made it her lifetime mission in her retirement to be involved actively in student civic education, and established her own nonprofit. I think it's called iCivics.
iCivics,
that in which she's promoting that, and that really has become her cause. We have local people who are involved in that. I mean, things like the Miami Foundation, other groups, the League of Women Voters. These are groups that are involved also actively.
The Children's Trust as well is involved.
And the Children's Trust is one of our partners in this project at Ethical Governance Day. They're right with us, and of course they have the interest in the young generation that is so important.
How about some information, Joe Centurino, for those listeners who perhaps would like to volunteer or just learn more about Ethical Governance Day? Again, it's Friday, October 12th.
Sure. Well, certainly anybody can call us at the Ethics Commission, 305-579-2594, 305-579-2594, or go on to our website. You can Google Miami-Dade Commission on Ethics, you'll find it, and if somebody wants to sign up to be to one of our guest speakers, anybody that really feels they have the background in civics and would like to participate in going into our schools and being part of this great community conversation, we'll be happy to include them with our volunteers. There's really nothing more important that they could do, I think, to help build the civic life.
I understand there's also going to be coverage on the Miami-Dade TV, the cable channel.
Right. The ethics forum with the candidates will be covered live by Miami-Dade TV.
How are you doing on getting the candidates to come and share their ideas and vision for ethics?
We're working on that, and we're hopeful that the opportunity to speak specifically to that issue. This is, as I said, this is not a regular forum that they're not going to be able to talk about their opponents or nobody's going to be able to throw any mud or
so
or
no
really,
partisan
it's not going to be partisan
politicking.
It's going to be just about ethics in government and where do we have to go to get to where we want to be.
So have you had many RSVPs?
No. Well, yeah, we've got people that will be coming and we're hopeful for to get as much of participation as possible.
Yeah, you only have 10 or 12 days left, so
right. Mm-hmm.
Again, we're speaking with Jackie Viana of the Miami-Dade County Public Schools and Joseph Santorino. He's the Executive Commission, the Ethics Commission Executive Director. Let's take a quick call. This is Dom in Miami. Hello there.
Hey, Mr. Cooper. I listen to your show as often as I can. I really think you do a great service to the community.
Thank you.
I got two points. Firstly, I didn't know that they still taught civics in school. Because when I talk to kids today, they have no clue about anything about their government. Secondly, the county representative there, Mr. Santorino, I guess it is, I would suggest, this is just a suggestion, that you start educating the people that work for the county. Because I've made public records requests from the county, from commissioners, and their chiefs of staff have denied me the information that I've requested. And I've had to go to the county attorney's office and force them to give me records. And it's incredible to me that the average person in this county, or I guess any community, doesn't realize that every piece of paper in every county, if you work for the county or any government, that's yours. You can go up there and access that. And it just astounds me of the ignorance when it comes to civics or government. That you really should start at the county, at your county, the people you work for.
Well, let's hear from the director, Joe.
Well, and I think his point is a valid concern. And I will tell you that part of the four-hour course that we have constructed for all 26,000 county employees includes a segment specifically on public records and the importance of providing access to public records. But anybody that has a problem with public records, they can call my office. The Ethics Commission will look into it. The State Attorney's Office will look into it. It is a law, and it needs to be enforced.
What are some of the recent successes of the commission?
Well, I think that we've made some headlines for some of the cases that involve individuals, and obviously things that we've done. I think this year, I think people have noticed one of the policies we put out had to do with the free tickets that a lot of times elected officials get. It started with Miami Beach, but it includes now everybody in the county, all the governments, where we've put together a policy where...
So there's no more free ride for fat cats.
Well, if they're going to take free tickets, there's going to have to be some public purpose to it. Let's put it that way, that they're simply not going to be given out to political supporters and used as a perk of office.
Well, let's recap the governance day, Mr. Santorino.
Well, and once again, we are looking for volunteers to work with us and to appear in public school classrooms and private school classrooms. We have over 50 schools that are participating in this project. They can call us at 305-579-2594 or find us on the web, Miami-Dade Commission on Ethics, and you can sign up right on the web. Or you can call us and discuss what you'd like to do.
You mentioned freedom of speech earlier, and I just was wondering how the censorship in schools enters into the picture of First Amendment rights.
Well, First Amendment right is the cornerstone of civic education. In fact, we put together some talking points for our speakers, and the first talking point is First Amendment and how crucial and critical it is to civic life in this country.
And Jackie Viana, Go over once again the school system's involvement in governance day.
The Division of Social Sciences is working closely with the schools, with the high school classroom teachers, and providing those the names to the Ethics and Governance Commission to provide those schools. I mean, we have great success, and we're working and getting even more schools involved.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. We've been speaking with the 2010 American Civics Education Teacher of the Year, Jackie Viana, of the Miami-Dade County Public Schools, and also the Executive Director of the Miami-Dade Commission on Ethics and Public Trust, Joseph Santorino. And Ethical Governance Day is Friday, October 12th. Thank you both very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Food and Dining, up next.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Excuse me, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys.
In China, a political murder mystery winds down. The Communist Party leader-to-be vanishes for a couple of weeks, and the face-off with Japan over uninhabited islands in the East China Sea. I'm Neil Conan, China in Transition. Rob Gifford will join us. Plus, the parent trigger. What really happened when parents mobilized to take over a failing school? Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Coming up today at 2.
Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Monday's Topical Currents and a visit by Time Magazine senior correspondent Michael Grunewald. Acclaimed for his vivid chronicle of the Florida Everglades, his latest book examines the $800 billion stimulus bill of the Obama administration and how it was reviled on both the right and the left. His new book is The New Deal. That's Topical Currents Monday at 1 o'clock.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Our Thursday food and dining segment has finally arrived. I'm here with chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastneimer, as well as colleague Bonnie Berman. And Linda, today we'll visit with a celebrity chef and get kitchen tips and answers to your questions. And she has big Southern California influences, Beverly Hills.
Whoa, that's right. Today, Bonnie and Joe, you're going to be kitchen experts.
Uh-oh.
And you'll have the answer to all your kitchen questions. Joe, remember the pie crust that you've been trying to make for how many years?
I had to call Linda one time. I was trying to make a banana cream pie. The banana filling came out well, but I couldn't get those little pea-shaped pie things. So I called Linda at home and tried to get help, and it still kind of came out like cardboard.
Well, that wasn't my fault.
No.
Thank you.
That was me.
Okay. Well, our guest today has the keys to the kitchen. She's Ada Mollenkamp, the Food Network star of Ask Ada and Food Crafters, and her book is Keys to the Kitchen. So welcome, Ada Mollenkamp.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you with us. We've got lots of questions for you. And also,
okay.
We'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any cooking kitchen setup questions? Maybe how to set up your kitchen or how to make something that you have failed to make, like Joe's pie crust? She's here to answer your questions.
I've got another question, too.
Okay,
go ahead. Good.
800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Or we can do email. That's radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org.
And also joining us later in the program is our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker.
Indeed.
Yes. He's joining us by Skype. You can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Let's go straight to Ada Mollenkamp. Help us with your kitchen wisdom. First, I want to know, what are your most frequently asked questions?
You know, it really depends on who I'm talking to. I would say that with my friends who cook a lot, it comes down to things like Joe was talking about and, you know, these little technique details. But with my friends who don't cook that much, they're calling me while they're in the aisle at the grocery store and wanting to know, when is this ripe and is this the right ingredient? And if I can't find this, what do I find? So it's, you know, people are asking everything from ingredient substitution questions all the way to technique, and so I made sure to cover that in the book.
Great. Well, it's a very thick book.
Yes,
with lots of information. It's a kind of a Bible. All right, Joe, your question.
Why are some things that seem so simple so difficult? For example, just the simple, perfect omelet.
Well, first of all, you're asking me a question that is, I feel like, is a question for life, is it not? I mean, there's a lot of things that seem simple that are actually difficult. You know, the beautiful thing about eggs is they're easy to make and they're kind of hard to make well. So there's something that you take a lot of time to master. And I think the common thing that people tend to do wrong with omelets is they don't heat the pan adequately. And if you don't heat the pan adequately with a lot of foods, it might not get as brown as you'd like or as caramelized. But with an omelet, it will stick to the pan or it will just, you know, be a complete disaster. So you want to make sure that pan's heating up for a couple minutes before you use it. If you have never made an omelet, I would suggest using a nonstick pan. And you do have to put in more fat than you would think. Make sure there's a nice kind of film all across the bottom.
Should
of
it be
the
butter?
Oil. I actually like to use oil so that, you know, you're not having to deal with it browning too much if you're still learning. Once you've learned it, please use butter because that's the classic French.
Yeah, oh, you've made him so happy, Ada. He was getting a sad face there for a minute. But when you say heat the pan, that includes a nonstick pan?
Yeah, I find that a lot of people just kind of put the pan on the stove and start cooking, and there they go, and they're off to the races. And really what needs to happen is pans are all made out of metal, and as we all know, things expand when they hit heat, so does metal. And if you don't let it expand and heat up properly, then you're going to basically have these, like, microscopic pockets that will grab onto the food no matter how much oil or anything you put in the pan.
That's
so
very
adequately heating, it really helps.
Well, that's very interesting because, as you mentioned, browning, I mean, so many people put a meat in the pan and it's kind of gray color instead of being nice and crisp and brown on the edge.
Yes, and I think that actually comes from not only inadequate heating the pan, but also I think the problem with all the competition shows is they make people think that cooking always has to be really fast and that you're kind of doing this quick step in the kitchen, and that's not the case. You really can let stuff sit and sear, and it will get a better crust. So the number one thing I say to people when they're making a steak, just a classic pan-fried steak, is to let it sit. If you have an adequately heated pan and a decent amount, like I said, that film of fat, when it will actually naturally release. And when it naturally releases and is easy for you to move, that's when you should flip it. If you're fighting the flip, then it's not ready to be flipped. It's telling you when it's ready.
Don't fight the flip. Bonnie, you have a question.
Yes, I have a question on how fast or slowly we're supposed to heat the pan. That's always something I don't know. I mean, do we put it on high or do we put it on medium?
It depends on what you're making. So I would say whatever the recipe says, you know, I always make sure to say heat on medium or heat on medium high. So go ahead and put it on that heat. And I would say if you're doing high heat, then probably just a minute, 1 to 2 minutes will be adequate. If you're doing medium heat, you're going to need up to 3 minutes. And the only thing I would say about that nonstick is you want to make sure you invest in good nonstick pans because the subpar ones, you know, that coating can come off and they cannot handle the real high heat. So if you're searing something, like your first time you're searing a piece of tuna, you actually want a stainless steel pan so that you don't have to worry about any kind of crazy films coming off in your food.
Okay.
Did you have another question?
I had another question regarding eggs, which is, I don't know how many times people have asked me, or I find when I eat hard-boiled eggs, that they're always either really easy to peel or impossible to peel.
Or and like you take rubber. Half the,
yes. What makes a good hard-boiled egg easy to peel?
An older egg,
well,
right?
Well, you know what I say to people is you can actually make different kinds of preparations for eggs depending on the age of the egg. So a really fresh egg is beautiful for pan frying and poaching. It'll like really hold together well. But an older egg will completely turn into shreds when you poach it, but it will be amazing to boil because it will peel really easily. What's happening is the older the egg gets, more air is going in the space between the egg itself and the shell, and then that air pocket kind of just stays there when it's boiling, and then it makes it easier to peel. So go for the older egg, and of course not a month old egg or anything, but just a couple weeks old is going to do great. And then after you boil them, put them in an ice water bath. Drain them after about 30 seconds and then just shake them around in the pan until they kind of crack up their shells. And I find that those two extra steps really help in making it easier to peel.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, Ada's here to answer your cooking questions. Give us a call. That's 800-743-WLRN. 800-743-9576. Maybe you have a question for Ada Mullenkamp. And Ada, now you start out by talking about people call you when you're when they're in the supermarket and they need some questions. All right, so picking prime produce is one of your sections and their book, Keys to the Kitchen. It's a difficult section of the market because it's so disappointing. You come home and your apple's not crisp or the green beans are moldy. This happened to me last week. I was really mad. How do you avoid this problem?
Well, you know, I think if you, the thing that you guys have a lot of down there in Florida is fabulous produce. And so if you have the time, it really makes a difference to be able to go to the farmer's market because you're going to get, the produce is going to be the freshest there. So first of all, you know, go to a place that has good turnover. And if it's not going to be at the farmer's market, then, you know, kind of explore the markets in your area. I know that I have grocery stores here in L.A. that it, you think that produce must be hanging around for come a month on end versus produce that seems like it just came in that morning. And then be okay with being noisy when you're in the farmer's market. When you're in the market and speak up to the produce guy and say, I don't know if this is ripe. Can you help me pick it? Or if it doesn't look good to you and you are able to see that it looks a little bit moldy, speak up and say, I want the fresher stuff from the back. Like, this is unacceptable. But I think that really the problem is a lot of the produce we're getting these days is prepackaged, and it's harder to tell if it's moldy or what have you. So whenever you can, buy the loose bulk produce, like, you know, how they just sell the apples unpackaged, because then you're really going to be able to turn them around and inspect them.
Right. And I love the you say weight matters. And I'm not talking about us. I'm talking about the produce. So why does weight matter?
Well, with almost pretty much every produce out there, the heavier it is, the like riper and better it's going to be, especially with things like melons and citrus, all the kind of round produce, tomatoes. Those are indicators that it's getting close to being riper. So if it seems bizarrely lightweight for an orange, it's probably going to be kind of mealy and not good. So
all right. Well, we have Christopher in Coral Gables. Christopher, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I'm calling because I like to cook, and I frequently use my gas grill outside because I find the electric stove on the inside doesn't get an even heat, and I'm thinking about replacing my range. So I'm wondering, do you prefer gas or electric for cooking in a house?
For a range?
Well,
yes.
Well, it's, the stovetop. So, Christopher, it's interesting you brought this up because I was down in Florida just a couple weeks ago cooking, and I didn't realize that a lot of people don't even have that option down there, and a lot of people have to have electric. And I would say if you can do it, if you can put it in and you can afford it, definitely go gas. It's going to be more responsive. At the same time, if you can get a real high-end electric stove, they're making them these days, so they are pretty responsive. And, you know, they're ones you can find out there. But I'm always going to be a fan of gas because it burns extremely efficiently. It's never as expensive as electricity, at least out here in California. And the gas is just, you know, you can actually physically see the size of the flame, which is going to tell you if it's high or low or medium.
But what about induction? I find that's quite responsive, but it is expensive. But what do you think?
It is extremely responsive. But yeah, I think it's still just not popular enough in the United States to be widespread affordable. But again, if price is not an issue for you and you're looking especially for responsiveness, induction is a great place to look.
Right. Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guest today is Food Network star Ada Mullenkamp. We'll take a short break here and we'll be back with more.
Thanks for joining us today. You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM, NPR for the Florida Keys.
Hi, I'm Michael Stock. Every Sunday on Folk and Acoustic Music, I present the best in contemporary and traditional bluegrass, blues, gospel, world music, folk music, and more, including guests in the studio. This week, from Bulgaria, blues artist Anna Popovich. Plus, celebrating the music of Astor Piazzolla, Fernando Gonzalez, and Scott Flavin from Festival Miami. The Public Storyteller is at 4 o'clock. Folk and Acoustic Music, Sunday, starting at 2.
This is Neil Conan, host of Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
In the golden age of radio, you trusted Ed Murrow and the networks to cover a world crisis. These days, the nets have all pulled out of Baghdad. Our commitment continues there and in Kabul and now Tripoli. We stay because the story isn't over and you need to hear the news. This is NPR.
And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Ada Molenkamp. She's the Food Network star of Ask Ada and Food Crafters, and she has a new book out, and it's called Keys to the Kitchen. And she's been giving us some really wonderful, great kitchen tips. So now I know that Joe's going to make me an egg omelet now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to tell Ada how you did it, how it came out.
And I'll bring you hard-boiled eggs.
Good. All right. We're on for that. Right now, Ada, we have each week a Dinner in Minutes section. And today's Dinner in Minutes is going to be balsamic veal with linguine and broccoli. And Joe, I know you and Bonnie have already been tasting it.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Nice and tart.
Bonnie, you're shaking your head. Oh, I know why. She doesn't eat meat. Well, the veal here, you could use
especially
chicken.
Especially veal.
You can use chicken here or even fish if you wanted to.
Okay.
It's bathed in the sauce with tangy balsamic vinegar, onions, and pineapple. It's so simple. All you do is cook the meat. Veal cutlets cook in about 1 to 2 minutes. Sauté it on either side and make sure your pan is warm before you put it in. And then take it out, sauté some onion with a little garlic, and add balsamic vinegar, a little water. You cook that down, pine nuts. This is like maybe a 10-minute dish that you can make. The sauce goes over the veal or chicken or fish. And then I buy fresh linguine. You can buy that in the supermarket. And I cook my broccoli florets and the linguine all in the same pan. So 2 or 3 minutes in boiling water, and you're done. And that recipe is in today's Miami Herald. If you want to find it easily, go to dinnerinminutes.com and click the columns section.
You cook the linguine and the broccoli at the same time?
Sure.
You put them in the same time?
Boil the water, put the pasta in. Pasta only could take 3-4 minutes. It's fresh, right?
Right.
And the broccoli florets take about that time. Put it all in together, drain it, a little olive oil, salt, and pepper, and it's very pretty. The picture in the paper
it is
today.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. And please follow me on Twitter at L. Gassenheimer. And now, Fred, what are we drinking?
Well, let's talk about cooking with wine and other alcohol. It can actually be great. I have a cheese fondue recipe with a cup of white wine and a pound of cheese. And I have a recipe for steak with brandied mushrooms with 4 steaks and 1/4 cup of brandy. And these are both absolutely delicious.
But they sound good, my God.
Yeah. But if you have to be careful about alcohol, the question arises after you cook these, is any alcohol left? And I can testify there was some left in my cheese fondue by how loud my guests got later. And you can actually taste it in the steaks. Now, I'm not trying to give any medical advice here because I'm not qualified, but I came across an FDA chart about cooking with alcohol that I thought was pretty interesting. And it turns out you can't blithely say, don't worry, I've cooked out all the alcohol. According to the FDA, if you flambé those steaks and mushrooms with brandy just until the flames go out, the finished dish will still have 75% of the alcohol left.
75, that's a lot.
It is.
Yeah.
And if you add wine to a stew or fondue before cooking, then after 15 minutes of simmering, you'll have 40% of the alcohol left. After an hour, it'll be 25%. And after 2.5 hours, it'll still be 5%, which I suppose is not very much. Now, in a previous show a couple of weeks ago, we had a caller who talked about getting vodka cupcakes at a restaurant.
Wow.
And thinking that all of the alcohol was baked out of that. But according to the FDA, if you put something in a mixture like that and bake it for 25 minutes, you still have 45% of the alcohol left.
So they do need to show their ID when they're buying cupcakes, huh?
I guess they do. No minors allowed. And finally, if you eat a piece of the holiday fruitcake that a friend of mine soaks in rum for several weeks, you're going to have a designated driver.
Wow. That's another interesting tip for the kitchen. Thank you so much, Fred Tasker.
My pleasure.
Okay. See you, Fred.
See you, Fred. See you.
Right. So, Bonnie, did you have another question you said?
Yes, I did. I hate to sound ignorant on the radio, but what's induction? You talked about gas and electric, but I don't know what induction is.
Ada, would you like to tell her?
Oh, sure. You know, induction is basically a type. We have all kinds of heat, right? We have electric and gas, and then induction is just another form of that. But it actually is very efficient because it takes the heat and transmits it directly to the pan. So it looks like a flat surface. You put a special kind of metal pan on, and then just immediately it is inducting the heat over as opposed to conducting. I'm not a scientist, so I can't explain every single detail, but it's way more efficient than gas or electric.
Okay.
And it is very responsive. You need special pans for it. But
I see.
But if you have electric, if you have, you have to have electric stovetop, and you really want to cook, you love to cook, it's worth the effort and the money. We'll go to
Philippe
in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Philippe. You're on the air.
Hi. Howdy. I actually had a question about using wood chips to smoke meat, in particular fish. I'm a home brewer, and I know that like different wood chips will impart different flavors on my beers. So I was wondering if the wood chip, like if you could maybe describe some of the different wood characters that are different smoke characteristics that different types of wood give when smoking.
So what kind of wood chips to use, different types?
Generally, I like using cherry or oak for beer, and I was thinking about making some smoked salmon and maybe using cherry, and I was wondering just if there was maybe something, a better wood to use.
Well, let's let Ada, we only have a minute left or so. Ada, go ahead, what's your advice here?
You know, I actually don't have a ton of experience with smoking because I live in an apartment building and can't do it, but all the different flavors that you're getting in your brewing are going to be pretty similar when you're smoking. So cedar is going to be more resiny, cherry a little bit more fruit flavored, and mesquite, that kind of smokiness that we all associate with mesquite.
I guess hickory's the most common, though.
You know, I think when you're looking for salmon, you're actually going to find the cedar planks in the market. You can soak those, throw them on the grill, and you'll get a good idea of what the salmon tastes like on that cedar plank, and then you can try the cedar smoking chips as well if you like that. So I think you just experiment with what you like in your beer. It's most likely what you're going to like in your food.
Maybe use the same. If you're having the cherry wood beer, have cherry wood smoked food. Actually, and that's another tip that you mentioned. Well, I think Joe mentioned it. Soak the wood chips.
Oh, yeah.
And then put them in a little box. And if you don't have a smoking box.
So they smoke and don't burn.
Right. You know, you can just have a heavy duty foil and just have it rolled up and open it at each end, and you'll get some nice smoking flavor that way. And so, Ada, we only have just really a short time left, and I wanted to know if you're, you know, if you're going to organize your kitchen, what's one good tip about if you're organizing your kitchen?
I would just put like with like. So I keep all my baking stuff together, I keep all of my pantry stuff together, and then I organize my spices based on ethnic food. So I put all the Thai kind of stuff together and all the Italian kind of stuff together, and it just makes it that much more efficient and easier.
I always use just alphabetical, so that's a better
way. That's
an
interesting, to do the ethnic together. And also, I think it's a great tip because if you have a section of your kitchen that's for baking and a section of your kitchen that's for something else, it really helps you to be more efficient in your kitchen.
Well, and I also think that you can kind of learn this is all Thai, this is all Italian, and then you're not going to be as scared later on when you say, Mexican and Indian spices are pretty similar. Let me try to be adventurous and use them both in some dish I'm making up. So, because, you know, the thing about Keys to the Kitchen is not just learning these how-tos, it's also to become adventurous and try new things as well.
Right, and in your Keys to the Kitchen, you have tips on, you have recipes as well as kitchen tips and I mean, it's really kind of like a Bible here of what to do in the kitchen. But we're just out of time. It's been a really interesting week. Ada Mollenkamp, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great cooking tips from Ada. And Fred Tasker gave us great advice,
of course,
as always.
And I'm going to make that omelet tomorrow morning.
Okay, you're going to let me know how it comes out, huh?
Maybe.
Maybe? All right. And Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, great tips. And Bonnie, you're going to try this recipe with some fish, maybe?
Maybe. maybe. Okay. I'm a little reluctant on the fish too these days.
All right, Joe, you and I are going to eat together, right? well, next week, we're going to be talking about my favorite food finds. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's program. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical supervision by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary gives production assistance as well. Remember, we have free audio archives of this and past programs at our website, WLRN.org. You can also follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like. Today's recipe at dinnerinminutes.com. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, it's literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez and Time Magazine senior correspondent Michael Grunewald. He's written an examination of the federal stimulus package in the book, The New New Deal. And now our calendar. On this day in 1954, 58 years ago, after 15 months on late-night local New York TV, Tonight with Steve Allen debuts on NBC. Later hosts are Ernie Kovacs, Jack Parr, Johnny Carson, and Jay Leno. And on this day in 1964, 48 years ago, the Beach Boys make their TV debut on The Ed Sullivan Show. Also appearing, Alan King and Robert Goulet. No little Topo Gijo or the Marquee Chimps. And one more while we reflect on the Ice Bowl and the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field. On this day in 1984, 28 years ago, the death of newsman and NFL Films narrator John Facenda at age 72. He was called the voice of God. And we leave with a definition from early Tonight Show host Ernie Kovacs, who died in an auto crash in 1962. Quote, television, a medium, so called because it's neither rare nor well done. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Also for Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
You're listening to